This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Gateless Gate, Case 1. Zhaozhou's Mu, the main case. A student once asked Master Zhaozhou, "Has a dog the Buddha nature or not?" And Zhaozhou said, "Mu." Woman's commentary. In studying Zen, one must pass the barriers set up by ancient Zen masters. For the attainment of incomparable Satori, one has to cast away their discriminating mind. Those who have not yet passed the barrier and have not cast away the discriminating mind are all phantoms haunting trees and plants. Now tell me, what is the barrier of Zen masters, of the Zen masters? Just this Mu. This is the barrier. It is thus called the gateless barrier of Zen. Those who have passed this barrier will not only see Zhaozhou clearly, but will go hand in hand with all the masters of the past and see them face to face. You'll see with the same eye that they see and hear with the same ear. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Don't you want to pass the barrier? Then concentrate yourself into this Mu. With your 360 bones and 84,000 pores, making your whole body one great inquiry. Day and night, work intently at it. Do not attempt nihilistic or dualistic interpretations. It's like having bolted a red-hot iron ball. You try to vomit it out, but can't. Cast away your illusory, discriminating knowledge and consciousness accumulated up to now, and keep on working harder. After a while, when your efforts come to fruition, all the oppositions, such as inside and outside, will naturally be identified. You'll then be like a mute person who's had a wonderful dream. Only you know it personally, within yourself. Suddenly, you break through the barrier and astonish heaven and shake the earth. It is as if you had snatched the great sword of General Quan. You kill the Buddha if you meet the Buddha. You kill the ancient masters if you meet them. On the brink of life and death, you're utterly free. And in the six realms and the four modes of life, you live with a great joy, a genuine life of samadhi in frolic and play. Now, how should one strive? With might and main, work at this Mu and be Mu. If you do not stop or waver in your striving, then behold, when the Dharma candle is lighted, darkness is at once enlightened. The poem. The dog, the Buddha nature. The truth is manifested in full. A moment of yes and no, lost, are your body and soul. So I mentioned on the other day that I wanted to talk about the mountain training and ascending the mountain, reaching the summit, and then descending the mountain. And this is a way of talking about the path, the journey within Buddha Dharma. The 10 ox herding pictures downstairs are a traditional and ancient depiction of that journey in verse and portrait, where the ox is the self and the student is the one looking, seeking the self. You know, another way of that's been spoken of is that the path is the development of concentration or samadhi, realizing self-nature, and then embodying that, actualizing that, integrating that throughout our lives. And these are just different ways of talking about how the path is a journey and has aspects to it that seem kind of sequential, you know, in the sense that when you are on a journey, your first steps take you into certain terrain, certain territory, and successive steps take you further into that terrain. And that ultimately you return home. The as is true with every metaphor and analogy and simile, they fail in some regards. And so here, while there is some semblance of a sequential nature, so that's why the sense of a path or journey is used and is resonates strongly, but at the same time, it creates the sense of, you know, first you just do this and wait, and then when this is done, then you do the next thing and wait, and then when that's done, you do the third thing. And it's not like that. You know, to constantly reflect on what is the all of the many implications of non-duality, of the world as not being separate and distinct. And of course, the journey, the spiritual journey, is perhaps one of the oldest stories. I was wondering whether it was older than the story of the self, but I have no idea. I think they would have to arise together. You know, for as long as we've been human beings and have wondered about and in this world of ours and been in awe, wonder and dread, seeing the impermanence of things, the fleeting nature of life, experienced sublime beauties and also terrible sufferings. Human consciousness is such that we wonder, why? Why? What is this for? Is there a purpose? It's the oldest question. Is there meaning? Are we just here like every other creature to be born and grow ourselves up and procreate and then die? There seems to be an eternal sense that there is more. And so the path is the journey into that question, that more. And Buddha Dharma, it is to see, the Buddha laid out the path. And he said it is a path to address the nature of suffering, the reality of suffering, in all of its many forms, dukkha, and to free ourselves of dukkha. And that it all comes down to self-nature, to understanding the nature of self and others. In the first Oxfordian portrait, the poem is, "In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the ox, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. My strength failing, my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the ox. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night." How do we find the ox? How do we search for that which, as the Buddha realized in his enlightenment, we already are? Fully endowed, fully present, fully manifesting, and yet so difficult to see, Buddha nature. It's like, how do you examine if you're water? How do you examine wetness if you're space? How do you examine vastness? How do we turn towards reality, right? When it seems as though we're doing that in every moment, aren't we? Turning our senses towards reality. And yet, if we were seeing things as they were and living in accord with what we see, then we should be living in harmony. And so the evidence is that something is not quite cricket. Is it that our sense organs are untrustworthy? Is it the objects of the world are somehow untrustworthy? The Buddha realized it's mind consciousness. Consciousness, which is laden and infused with years and years, perhaps lifetimes, of dust, of views and false views and prejudice in the sense of seeing things from a slanted perspective and from an inclination that inclines towards self-preservation, self-affirmation, self-creation, and the avoidance of everything that threatens that. So how do we use those very same instruments and this very same consciousness? How do we turn towards the real and not turn it into an object, which just creates further separation? How do we strive, as Master Wu Men says, without just creating another goal outside of ourselves? And so skillfulness, how to practice, becomes paramount, is paramount from the very beginning. In Lankavatara, the passage I read the other day, the Buddha said, when you know directly that all experience, everything we perceive, is a perception of mind, it's not something that exists autonomously into itself, then we can know without perceiving. Then we can know without relying or having freed ourselves of that consciousness which is constantly clouding. When nothing is perceived, the Buddha said, then the knowable does not appear, doesn't arise. And so the koan in this, in our tradition, is how do you turn towards reality, phenomena. So every koan is one aspect of phenomena. And in the koan training, there is the first koan, which is always, in most ways, in many ways, the most difficult koan, because it is an utter wilderness. It is entering into something that is not like anything before. And yet it has many familiar appearances, which is part of its challenge. Its language, its words, its meaning. And so how do we enter into the koan? So the first koan is always a particular koan. And in the tradition, the mu, Zhaozhou's mu, has been traditionally one of the sort of preeminent koans, the first koans. Hakuin used his own koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping, as the first koan. But the first koan has a very particular quality, you might say, or a very particular purpose to help the student do much of what Wu Men is talking about in his commentary. It's interesting, this is the shortest, in terms of word count, the shortest koan in the collection, and it's the most verbose commentary that Wu Men offers. It's said that he himself worked on it for 8 years before he saw it. And so he says, the great barrier that's set up by the ancient masters to help us cast away discriminating consciousness, the gateless gate. And so in taking up this koan, we have to be aware of everything that we're bringing into it, which is a great deal. More than we know. But in particular, we have to let go of every dharma view of emptiness, of realization, of samadhi, of unity, of liberation, to cast away discriminating consciousness, the mind that seizes upon, identifies, names, establishes characteristics. And in a sense, to study anything is like this. We have to really study anything closely. We have to cast away our discriminating consciousness about that thing itself. And so how do we study the self? Well, we have to see moment by moment every aspect of discriminating consciousness that is establishing this sense of self and cast it away, which really means just don't produce, don't create. Don't further strengthen. And when something arises, something seems to be there. Something difficult, something delightful. Though when we look closely, we can't find it. When something arises, someone seems to be there, having that experience. Someone who's impatient, someone who's eager. But when we look, where do we find that someone? My strength failing, my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the ox. Most of us come into practice driven by suffering, in all of its various forms. And we just wanted to stop, right? Is that asking too much? We just wanted to stop. We want to just go away. Then everything will be fine. And what the Buddha realized is that, in a sense, that's what we've been doing our whole lives. It's just trying to get it to stop. And in that very effort, very often we're just creating more distance. And so he said, the whole path of the Buddha Dharma is to give relief to the mind, to take it down to the roots. And so Wumen says, do not attempt nihilistic or dualistic interpretations. All of the ways in which we try to put things into their proper place, identify and categorize. It is and it isn't. I am or I'm not. So that casting away, so that we can enter into what Dogen calls the inner chamber, the great mystery, self-nature, the nature of the universe. You know, I was thinking about how when I was young, I was 15, and I had been reading, and I hadn't encountered Buddhism yet, but I was reading and trying to sort things out and find something that seemed to have some whisper of sanity and understanding. And I grew up in a non-religious home, but I talked my childhood sweetheart, bless her, who was a little older than me and had a car, to go. Most Sundays we'd go to a different church and just check it out. What's going on in there? Do they know something? And that's after a period in which I was convinced that they didn't know anything, based on nothing, based on complete ignorance. But confident, as a 15-year-old young fella can be, about what they don't know. So then I began to think, well, wait a minute, maybe there's something going on. Maybe they do know, they. And so every Sunday most Sundays we'd go to a different church. And I wasn't looking for a religion. I mean, I don't think we went to any church that wasn't Christian, or any place that wasn't Christian. It was hard to find anything else in Georgia at that time. Actually, there were other places, but anyway, so we would go and I'd sit there and try and understand. I wasn't looking to see, is this for me? But I was just, do they know something? Is there something about what this is that is alive and meaningful and addressing what I was feeling in their lives? I didn't know how I would recognize that. I just, in my confidence, I just figured I would see something. And was generally not deeply inspired. And then when I was 15, I went on a bicycle trip down to South Georgia with a friend of mine, Blair, over spring break. And we went to a commune, a Christian commune in South Georgia, one of the oldest communes in the country, still very much in existence, and considerably more established, called Koinonia. And we spent a week there. And it's curious when I think back about that, because I was pretty decidedly not seeking Christianity. I was not really that interested at that point in my life in Christianity. And yet there I went to spend a week in a Christian commune. Nor was I, to my mind, looking for a community. So it's interesting how the things that we do, when I look back, is like, did I know something in advance that was driving me that I didn't understand yet, wasn't even conscious to me? And so we spent a week there living the life, just like people who come in here and are in residency. And on the last day, Sunday, before we had to ride back home, I went to a church service, which the community provided for local community people on the grounds. It was really just in a little one-room cabin, kind of like a classroom. And when I went in, they told me about it, and they said, if you want to go, you can go. My friend wasn't interested, but I figured I'd go. And I went in, and I had long hair, and I was, you know, white. And everybody in this room was African American. Everybody in the, and it was, you know, maybe 20 people, 25 people. And I was clearly not from around those parts. And so I just sat there and listened to the service. And they didn't have a minister or preacher. They just took turns getting up. And I expected something kind of charismatic or, you know, lively in that way, and it wasn't. It was very grounded. It was very unaffected. It felt very, there was something about it that was captivating. And part of it was that I didn't know these people at all, but I knew a little bit of history, and I knew a little bit about that part of the country. It was rough country. I was told not to go out at night alone because of my long hair, that it would not be safe. And so I knew I was in pretty rough country, and that that these people I was sitting with had probably lived hard lives or had hard experiences and for generations. And their naturalness, what felt like naturalness to me in their acknowledgement of me, which was very simple. They weren't particularly thrilled that I was there, but they weren't upset that I was there either. I mean, that was my experience. It was just very, it was okay. But what was more compelling was the service itself and the simplicity and the quietness of it. And that because of that, I felt like what I was experiencing was something that was very much alive and was completely integral to their lives. I didn't understand it. It was not my language. It was not my world. But just observing them, feeling them, watching them, and experiencing their key, their aliveness, and the honesty of that, there was something about that that changed me, that made a deep, deep impression on me. And it was the first moment where I thought, it exists. In the world, it exists where there can be faith or religion or path that has this kind of impact on people. This is not my path. But it was the moment where I thought, okay, then maybe there is such a path that I can find that speaks to me. So I'm indebted to those people. So in taking up Mu, in searching for the ox, we bring into it everything. And we're told from the outset, it's not in the meaning. It's not about the word. It's not about a dog. It's not about Buddha nature. In other words, anything we think it's about, we have to release. Mu here is not no as opposed to yes. It's not empty versus fixed. It's not unified rather than separate. It's not enlightened rather than deluded. This koan is without precedent. when the student takes it up. There's no precedent. You can't lean back on what you know. You can't lean back on what you've done before. Some of that will be useful. Some of it will not. And you don't know which is which. That's what you have to sort out. Each student has to discover for themselves by being very awake, very attentive, staying true to the koan itself, the Dharma, and true to oneself. There is nothing like this in the student's experience. There's therefore nothing to fall back upon. But what the student knows is that others have come before you. And that's not a small thing. Others have walked this very same path. Others have sat with this very same koan, wrestled with it in exactly the same way you are, have carried forth all of those ideas and conceptualizations and certainties and attachments. We're not that different. They have carried all of that into it, and they have also, at steps along the way, cast those away, had that much faith and trust, and entered more deeply into the wilderness, into not knowing. To cast away illusory, discriminating knowledge and consciousness accumulated up to now, and keep on practicing diligently. You know, it'd be nice if it was like, if that was all just stored up in a shed somewhere. You know, you just get a U-Haul, back it up, get it, and just throw it all away at one fell swoop. It's very neat and clean. It's just not that way. We don't even know what we have accumulated. We don't see it as accumulation. We see it as me. We see it as the world. We don't see it. We don't even see it as me and the world. And so he says, so keep practicing diligently. So all of those karmic webs we have spun, maintained, we protect, we believe in, day by day, step by step, become apparent. They appear. We begin to recognize. We begin to see patterns. We begin to see actions and results, cause and effect, over and over. It becomes very reliable in what we begin to see, but it still takes us by surprise again and again. And there are moments where we think we're looking up the path and we can see it. You know, if you've ever done hiking, you know what it's like when you're walking up a path and you look up and you can see it. It's right there. And then you get there and it's like, no, that's not it. But then you see it again and you go, and it's like, no, that's not it. And so it often is. The students will come in working on Mu and they'll say, in so many words, I'm so far away from this. How do they know? How do they know? How do you know how far away you are from something you have never seen and is unimaginable? Or students will come in and say, I'm very close. Right? And I mean, these aren't just random comments. It's based on what they're experiencing. They're experiencing something that conveys to them a sense, I can't possibly be near this gate. Or I must be near this gate. Because they're having experiences in their meditation, which most often are valid. But that's where those experiences themselves can become not invalid, but untrustworthy when we turn to them and hang on to them and expect something. And so we cast off. And so this koan is relentless in its demand that you continue to cast off. And of course, the koan is not anything. It's not consciousness. It's not the hand of God. It's not, you know, Buddha reaching out, you know, through the cosmos to guide you along the path. It's you at every step along the way. We don't know that yet. We're convinced that's not true. We wonder why it has to be so difficult. We're willing to make bargains. I remember so many moments where I was like cutting deals on that cushion. Like with who? You know? But it was like a form of desperation and entertainment. Okay, what would I be willing to... Cast off really just means one undivided moment. One undivided moment. Seeing mu is not samadhi. Samadhi can be very, is powerful in and of itself. It's transformative to a degree in and of itself. It does transform consciousness, but not at the root. Because samadhi is based in the state of your consciousness, right? Which is a result of your practice. And that's impermanent. And so that's why we shouldn't get too fixated on any experience we're having in meditation, difficult ones as well as ones that seem sublime. They're all impermanent. And so to cast off is just one undivided moment. What we're casting off does not disappear, in a sense, nor does it remain. It's not something. It is a gateless gate. And so, step by step, as I said the other day, we are able to practice the Dharma in a way that is true, even though we don't yet understand it. And even though it's not fully integrated, it's not that we're, let's not get into measuring. And yet each step along the way, when we're practicing sincerely, we are practicing authentically. And so we can think, well, if I'm practicing the true Dharma, why don't I realize the true Dharma in this moment? And we just don't yet understand a few things. Karma, attachments, the journey itself, self-nature. But step by step, we practice, we cast away what needs to be cast away and keep on practicing so that we can directly realize this very place, this very body of the Buddha, this Buddha mind. In the commentary, Shibayama says, Master Woman presents a simple, direct, and clear koan. Its simplicity plays an essential role. And that's very true. The first koan is always, in essence, a very simple koan. That doesn't mean it's easy at all. But its essence is very simple. There are other koans that, by their nature, are complicated. Right? It's like a complicated situation. Right? Think of some in your life. Right? Where there seems like there's a lot going on. There's a lot you could get tangled up in. There's a lot of things that you don't understand. There's a lot of people talking. Right? How do you find your way in? How do you discover what's true? How do you not get lost when you're not sure if the people in front of you are lost or not? Koans are life. Yeah, of course they're presented from the time and place in which they came into being as koans. And that's part of it. And part of that is a challenge because it's historical, and so we have to learn language and understanding, but it's Dharma study. You know, we study Dharma teachings. You know, every student is studying Dharma teachings. We rely on them. This is Dharma study in all of its aspects. And so when you read a sutra, you have to learn about certain words and what do they mean in terms of Buddhism. You have to understand certain concepts and principles. And then you apply those into your practice. This is no different. But their purpose, just like the sutras, is awakening. And so the koan begins with a word, mu. It begins with this dialogue. It begins as something conceptual in the student's mind. And then holding that, because the student is a practitioner, it immediately begins to mingle with the non-conceptual mind. It begins to be directed or pointed directly into the deeper heart of things. Because the student is not, in many moments, sitting there and just thinking about it. Meaning, in some moments, they will be sitting there and thinking about it. But so holding it in that way, they are discovering how to use the whole of their mind, the whole of their consciousness, the whole of their being. Again, without really knowing it, right? We don't have that perspective at that moment, right? All we have is mu. That's it. But then practicing, developing some stability, strength of concentration in every form of meditation, whether it's the breath or shikantaza or a koan or a visualization or a mantra, has those three trainings, those three essential trainings, the cultivation of compassion, not doing harm, developing your mindfulness and your concentration and insight. And so that's a part of the koan. And so here, the student has to be able to hold mu in their mind, in mindfulness, in concentration. And in that, it gains strength. And the subject-object nature of the koan begins to loosen and drop away. And the student will necessarily encounter themselves, the self. The koan is a study of this way. And they study the way through the koan, but the koan is nothing but the self. And the koan is ultimately a moment of forgetting that self, one undivided moment. And ultimately realizing the 10,000 things. That's one reason there are so many koans. Because we have to realize the true nature of both self and other. That's what the Mahayana. It's not enough just to realize that the self is impermanent and has no autonomy, no self-existence, no inherency. We also have to realize that about all of phenomena. And there's a whole bunch of phenomena. And so so different koans are basically bringing the student to different pieces of the world and humanity and life. And so as things begin to drop away, drop away, drop away, all that remains is mu. Shibayama says, Xiaozhou, like the great teacher that he was, responded to this student's question, mu. Now, of course, all creatures have Buddha nature. So the student asking, does a dog have Buddha nature? From a Buddhist perspective, the question is known already. And yet, Xiaozhou, this great master, answers mu, which does mean no. And so Shibayama says, Xiaozhou threw himself through the whole universe out as mu in front of the questioner. Here is no Xiaozhou, no world, only mu. This is the koan of Xiaozhou's mu. He says the experience of Buddha nature itself is creatively expressed here by mu. Although literally it means no, in this koan it points to the incomparable realization which transcends yes and no, to the direct experience of the real nature of things that we perceive when we cast away the separation-making mind. All suffering arises from a sense of distance, of separation, of self and other. And so in order to practice mu, realize mu, that has to not merge, not unify, not become one. These are words that we do use, but we should understand when we use those words, what we're really saying is not create. Because to merge is an action which takes two things that are separate and somehow merges them into one. That's much too busy. That too will come apart. That too is conditioned existence. That too ultimately is unreliable. This was the great brilliance of the Buddha's understanding of what he was seeking before he had discovered it. He knew that liberation had to be reliant upon nothing. It had to be reliant upon no state of mind, no action, no belief, no idea, because it would, whatever that might yield, that will come apart. That will dissolve. That is impermanent. That is dukkha. And the fact that he understood that so profoundly, thank you for that. And so the koan is to help us not produce our own bondage, to realize our own freedom, to you yourself be directly mu, you yourself, and the whole universe is nothing but mu. That's the summation of all of the instruction that it is possible to give on mu. That's basically it. It's true and it's direct. Within the training and the development of the koans, the teachings of faith, doubt, and determination became sort of identified taught, you know, brought out as being very important, not just to practice, no matter what our practice is, into the path, but specifically and particularly to the koan training. That great doubt in samsara, ultimately in the reliability of our karmic consciousness, of our impulses and our desires, of what we think we should rely upon in any given moment. More and more, we begin to wonder. We're not sure. And that's very difficult. It's very difficult to begin to necessarily let go of that sort of impulsive, reactionary reliance upon that, and then not know what to trust. That's very difficult because we have to trust something. And the intention, the purpose, the need is that we trust the Dharma. But it's not always clear what that means in terms of what is happening inside of you. And that we have to discover. We have to live it. We have to practice it. And then the great faith in our own Buddha nature, in the skill power of the koan, in those who have come before us, in our own capacity, and then perseverance, to persevere, to just be determined, to be resilient, to be steadfast. All of these ways of talking about this incredible, these qualities that we have as human beings, which make everything good possible. But how to hold that doubt, how to manifest that determination is very important, right? Because as Woman's commentary suggests, it's possible, you know, to, and it was very much part of Zen tradition and teachings and was part of our own training much more in the early years, of this fiery, fierce determination, right? Which is very powerful. But it's very powerful, we have to hold it very carefully. And it's a way of bringing forth one's own spiritual urgency, the imperative, spiritual imperative that Roshi used to talk about, and to basically give it voice through the koan, to channel that energy into the koan, into practice. But if we don't hold it carefully, then it just becomes a big knot. Right? Which can also be very powerful if we release that knot, and when we release that knot. But it's not the only way that people work on the koan and study in general and bring forth that great imperative. It can also be manifests very quietly with a fierce and quiet determination, with an unwavering and gentle persistence. And so the koan brings us up to the precipice of it all. And in that, we learn how to practice. If we want to move forward, we have to learn how do you practice this and this and this and this, so that we realize self-nature. That's what Kensho means, to realize self-nature. The direct experience that transcends itself and other, subject and object, concepts, discriminating consciousness, to know without perceiving, to understand without knowing. And so in essence, when Wu Man says that we have to pass through the barriers set up by the ancient masters, Mu is one way in which that barrier is presented to us. One way. Right? The Buddha didn't practice Mu. Right? Most Buddhists throughout history have not practiced koans. And it is a very unique and powerful form of practice, which is, in essence, no different than other forms of meditation and zazen and inquiry. And like any form of practice, we have to learn, which is powerful. And particularly zazen, all forms of zazen are very powerful practices. We should appreciate that. Right, we might think, you know, practicing my breath, following the breath, it's very simple. It is, but it's also very powerful. And that's why it's important to practice it well. To practice it well in the sense, not that you never have thoughts, but well in the sense of being faithful to what the teachings are asking us to do. That if we want to follow this path, we should follow this path. That means practice in accordance with the teachings. That will help us to stay on the path. It will help us to navigate all of those moments of great power that are pivot moments where it could strengthen or exacerbate the very things we're trying to relieve ourselves of. Or it can liberate us. And both are going to happen. We will get mired. We will entangle. We will not always practice. We will oftentimes trust our karmic mind and what we think we want and need more than what the Dharma is teaching us. But if we continue to have faith, at some point we will right ourselves. We will correct ourselves, right? And in that process, if we're paying attention, we will learn something invaluable. And so the more powerful the practice, in a sense, the more attentive we need to be. And in a certain sense, that means the more important it is to you, and the more you bring yourself to it, the more attentive you should be. Because you're in the midst of something that has great power. It's the analogy is, you know, if you're going to pick up a poisonous snake, you better know how to pick it up. And after you get bit a few times, you know, we learn. And part of training is to hold us so that when we get bit, it doesn't go too deep. It's not too poisonous, right? The antidote is near at hand. That's part of training, is that we're not just out there on our own, flying blind. The dog, the Buddha nature, the truth is manifested in full. A moment of yes and no, lost are your body and soul. In order to lose the body and mind, to all of our clinging. We have to become lost to the body and mind in order to rediscover body and mind, to return home to this body and mind. We must lose the body and mind. This is reaching the summit. And so tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about descending the mountain training. When the Dharma candle is lit, darkness is at once enlightened. It's here all along. Every moment of practice is lighting that candle. And so let's practice throughout this session. You know, let's really appreciate all that we've been doing this week, and that when we sit and begin turning our attention to tomorrow and the next day, right? It's easy to understand. That's our habit mind, right? That's what we do, right? But then just reflect for a moment, what is this week about, right? What have we been doing every moment, practicing every moment? And it's really important part of training to carry things all the way through, right? The more we do that, the more we live that way, right? To let go of past and future thinking, right? So there's these hours that we have ahead of us provide us with that. So just be aware of that tendency so that we really, you know, it's like the fruit is very full, right?
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.